to people who've not been accepted, to help the marginalized, and we're only scratching the surface when it comes to serving our community. And that's what the questionnaires have been about. Ben is keen to find out if there are any common threads amongst the people filling in these questionnaires. What bothers you? What burdens you? What are you passionate about? What are you good at? Without being boastful, what are you good at? What do you feel your skills are? What do you feel your gifts are? And so Ben's going to pore over all that data and just see if we can capture the heart of the people and see what happens from there. So we are a community church and we're a church community. That's all about relationships. We need to get that foundation right. I also felt burdened, if you like. That's a kind of old-fashioned word, really. I felt like it was quite important that I spent some time talking about dating, the dating game. So I'm specifically speaking to young people or single people today, and I know that that's not the majority. But I could have got people together and done a small group, but I kind of felt it was important to lay across the whole congregation where we stand as a leadership team in a 21st century context, because however old you are, there's someone in your life who you know, who might have questions. You might have a grandchild, and there might be just one thing that I say today that just helps you talk to them. So it's also good to be able to encourage younger people as well. So you all know where we're coming from as a leadership team on the dating game. Next week, we're going to talk about staying married and happy, because a lot of Christian couples know that they have to stay married, and they do that out of a sense of law and loyalty. But I'm going to talk about staying married and happy, and then hopefully Andrea will get the message. Poor woman. We've got some great marriages in this church, and I honour that. I think that's fantastic. Sam Madison's away this weekend because she and Clive are celebrating 30-something years together. Andrew and I will be 22 years this year in July, and we've got some other fantastic, strong, happy marriages in our church, and I just want to uphold that, and we'll talk about that a little bit next week. Quite light-hearted, I think. And then finally, Paul's going to talk about family life, because he's got more years under his belt than me. And I heard a comment from a preacher who said his target was, a couple of weeks ago was half term. Andrea, me, our two kids, went to Cornwall. We did a three-day camping trip, and we extended it to 4 days because the weather was so nice. And I was asked this morning if I'd had a spray tan. It was the Cornish sunshine. So that was an attempt at a Cornish accent, and it went really badly. So I'll stop there. And in that moment, there was one moment, which is a very rare moment in our family, and that was I engaged with my son in a sporting context. See, I don't do sport. I don't find it interesting, and I'm rubbish at it. I stayed up to watch the England game. I wish I'd turned it off before the extra time came on. That was just, you know, when I watch it, I do get involved, you know, and I was angry. Right up till bedtime, I was angry about those Russian pests. Sometimes you just love extra time when it works for you, but last night I wanted to cry. So that was another rare moment where John Pett's engaged in something sporting. And the irony is that my son is just all about sport. You know, he just loves all things sporty. Anyway, so we were camping, and there was one moment where we played what he calls quick cricket. And it wasn't quick enough for me, but he called it quick cricket. I think it was a bit like French cricket. But have you ever played a game with someone, and it doesn't take too long before you realise they're playing by different rules? Have you done that? I mean, you know, you've learnt your rules in a different context. So something like what he was trying to get me to play was something like what I vaguely remember in the haunted wing of my mind from my childhood. And it's like, can I bowl you out here? No, you've got to bowl me out there. The only place you can stump me is there. And I'm like, what about there? What about where you're running to? No, you got. What about here where I'm bowling from? No, you're. It's like, all right, okay. And it turns out the rules are, I throw the ball, he hits it 1,000 miles, I go for a very long walk, and we're both exhausted at the end of it, and it's called quick cricket. But at one point, I felt we were playing by different rules. It's the same game, but different rules. And that's why I've called today's talk the dating game. Because I grew up in a non-church school, like this one is, that we're meeting in this morning. And in my school, I soon realized that the world I was living in when I was at school was a different world from the one I was living in when I was in church. On the one side, there were these what we call secular values. If you don't know what secular means, it means non-religious, all right? So there were these just general worldly values. And then when I go to church or was in my family, because it was a Christian family, there was a different set of values. It was like playing two different games. And I was kind of in the middle, so I'd go to church on Sunday. And in this world, in the church world, I should be over this side really, because it matches the pictures. In the church world, you lot are the religious lot, you're all the secular lot now. We've just divided the sheep and the goats, okay? Goats, sheep, make a goat noise. Yeah, see, they proved it. Sheep noise. Yeah, brilliant. Okay, anyway, in the church world, there were these values, and it was like a different, it was like kind of like the same game, the game of life, but different language. There was language we use in this context that we don't use in that context, and there's definitely language in this context that we don't use in the other context. And there were, I had church friends, and I had school friends, and some of them overlapped, and you could catch some school friends out using school language in church, and then you can point and laugh and condemn and make them feel bad. But there was, because there was a bit of an overlap, some of the friends that I went to church with also went to the same school. But there was different values. That was the key thing, different values. And when it came to talking about sex, that was the main one. That was the main area where I found I was in two different worlds. And I had to choose which rules to play by. To play by the ones that I'd grown up in church in, or to play by the rules that I experienced and saw my friends expressing. Now, I spent 9 years in that school because I did my A-levels in the same place. And then I did some other stuff. And then I became a teacher. An RE teacher, where I had to teach on all sorts of issues, because RE isn't like many of you remember. Some of you remember RI, which was religious instruction. That's all gone, okay? It's now called philosophy and ethics in this school. And so we don't do Matthew, Mark, Luke and John, Acts and Romans, follow on, and all that sort of. That's not RE anymore. It's abortion, euthanasia, and what the religious groups think about that, and what the non-religious groups think about that. War and peace, all that sort of stuff, moral issues. So I used to teach some of this stuff. So I've had 20 years in a school context as a teacher, engaging with and counseling in some cases young people from age 11 up to 19, right? Because the 19-year-olds are the ones who had to resit part of their A-levels. So I was in an 11 to 19-year-old school and spent a lot of time at the top end in the sixth form. I was a sixth form tutor. I was head of sixth form for a little while. And I spent a lot of time sitting in my office with crying people over stuff like Snapchat and whatever else has been going on. And I'd spent 9 years as a person in school. So I'm not qualified in any other way but except through experience. And in all of that experience, I've worked out that the world's values boil down to two pieces of advice. Okay? Are you ready for them? This is my thinking. It might not be yours. It's my experience. It's what I think, generally speaking, is the world's advice. Number one, if it feels good, it is good. Okay? If it feels good, it is good. Now, people don't all say that. Some people, you know, they'll talk in RE lessons. They'll talk about what's morally right, what's morally wrong. They'll talk about self-sacrifice and things like that. But most people's actions, a lot of the time, boil down to value one, if it feels good, it is good. The second one is, talking particularly about sex now, be safe. That's the main thing that we're taught, is be safe. Teachers teach it. You do it in what we used to call PSHE lessons. I don't know what it's called now. Personal, social, health, and whatever else, education. It's kind of like RE without religion, just like how to live life. And teachers teach about using a condom and all that sort of thing. Be safe. Okay, so to elaborate that one, it's kind of like wait until you're absolutely sure and then use a condom. And then there's kind of like, and if you can't wait until you're absolutely sure, use a condom. And that's about all it boils down to. Okay, is this too personal for you? Sorry. Anyway, so I want to just look at those two values and then get into a text in the Bible which I found quite challenging, and I will find quite challenging to deliver because I know it's not, it's countercultural, but I'm just going to tell you what the Bible says. You can hate me for it, and then you can go home and do whatever you like. Okay, so let's think about the first one. If it feels good, it is good. Well, first of all, I think the Bible disagrees with that idea, and I also, secondly, I think logic disagrees with that idea as well. But just to look at one part of the Bible, and to pick something that does feel good, that's not good, according to the Bible. If you're a Bible person, if you're a God person, this will mean something to you. If you're not interested in the Bible, then you can just find it. You've got more evidence to point the finger at Christians, okay? So Christians should believe this. It's in Proverbs 5. Now, these parts of Proverbs, Proverbs was written by a guy called Solomon. He's known as the wisest man. He's even still known today for his wisdom, the wisdom of Solomon. And he wrote a lot of Proverbs, which are like words of advice, and they were aimed at young people. Because a lot of this chapter starts with the verse with the words my child, or my son. Okay, so this is aimed at young people, even though it's a little bit more adult in content. It says, for the lips of an immoral woman, that's a woman who's doing stuff wrong, okay, the lips of an immoral woman are sweet as honey. Well, I like honey, so that means it feels good. Okay. Remember, we're challenging the value on the left that says if it feels good, it is good. The lips of an immoral woman feel good, and her mouth is smoother than oil. Okay, now whether that's her talk or whether it's just a good kiss, but the lips of an immoral woman, they feel good. But I'm challenging the idea that if it feels good, it is good, because it continues to say, but in the end, she's as bitter as poison, as dangerous as a double-edged sword. There's no escaping the sharp edges of a double-edged sword. You're not immune to it. Nobody's immune to it. So here's one idea. If it feels good, it is good. But then the Bible seems to contradict that. Here's something that feels good, but it's not good. But you, even if you're not a Bible person and you're not a Jesus follower, that logic kind of tells you that although sometimes we live our lives as if it feels good, it is good, logic kind of tells you it doesn't make sense. You know lots of things that feel good that aren't good. That extra cream cake, smoking those cigarettes or smoking anything really isn't that good for you, but it might feel good. You know, I've listened to people try and put me off smoking before, especially as a teenager, and say, oh, it makes you feel sick and all that sort of stuff. Well, actually, most people I talk to say, actually, smoking's really nice. It's a pleasurable experience. You know, you might cough a few times. I'm not trying to promote it. I'm just saying sometimes things feel good, but they're not good. But take a simpler example, not doing your homework. That feels good, you know, but it's not good. So we can't really live our lives by this. If we're going to live our lives by this value, we're going to get caught in all sorts of bother. This morning, and you might have preferred it if this happened, but when my alarm went off, what felt good was to stay in bed. And by the time I finish this, you're going to wish you'd stayed in bed, especially if you're single. If it feels good. So I don't fully agree with that one personally, because of the Bible and because of logic. The second value that we want to look at and challenge is, what was it? Be safe. Be safe. Right, the only way I feel like I can challenge this is just to say that just to see sex as something that you've got to be safe about is completely watering down the beauty and the potency, that's the power of sexual attraction. If all it is something that you've got to be safe over, then all it is something physical. And the underlying idea of being safe is that sex is just physical. And the Bible, as we're going to see, teaches that sex is more than physical. It's personal, it's intimate, and it's designed to be an expression of marital intimacy. Well, we'll see that in a few moments. But before we get there, let's just have a look at a few verses from the Song of Songs. Now, the Song of Songs wasn't really written for young people, right? If you understood Hebrew, which is the language it was written in, and you could understand the meaning of this, you'd realize that actually it's quite graphic. And young boys weren't allowed to read this until after their bar mitzvah because it's quite graphic. So it's kind of love poems, celebrating sexual attraction between a man and a woman. So I just pulled out a few verses. You have captured my heart, my treasure, my bride. You hold it hostage with one glance of your eyes, with a single jewel of your necklace. You, your love delights me, my treasure, my bride. Your love is better than wine, your perfume more fragrant than spices. Your lips are as sweet as nectar, my bride. Honey and milk are under your tongue. Your clothes are scented like the cedars of Lebanon. That's a good thing. You are my private garden. Now we're getting into metaphors again. You are my private garden, my treasure, my bride, a secluded spring, a hidden fountain. Your thighs shelter a paradise. Wow. You never thought you'd get all this in church, did you? Wow. And what I haven't put on the screen is that's near the end of chapter 4. So he said his lover is like a garden and her thighs shelter a paradise. And in chapter 5, verse 1, it says, I have entered my garden. First, you go and look it up. She didn't have room for it on the screen. But what I'm trying to show is that the Bible teaches that sex is good and sex is a gift from God. And sex is a beautiful, intimate, wonderful thing. It's more than just something you've got to be safe over. It's more than something to be careful with. It's something that's beautiful. In fact, it's so beautiful, it's meant for just one person. Have a look at the next thing. This goes back into Proverbs 5. It's the same chapter that talked about the immoral woman whose lips are like honey. And this one gets... I'm using the New Living Translation. And this one gets really graphic. I've actually cut it off here because I'll just get too embarrassed to read it. I'm not joking, actually. I was going to go to verse 20, but I just could. If you look this up in the New Living Translation, some of you are doing it now on your Bible app, you see why I just didn't fancy reading it right now. Okay. Drink water from your own well. Share love only with your wife. Andrea, that's what I'm committing to do. It's what I have done for 22 years. Why spill the water of your springs in the streets having sex with just anyone? You should reserve it for yourselves. That's, in fact, I think the Hebrews, there's singular. Reserve it for yourself. It affects you if you go beyond just you, but they've put it as plural as you and your wife, okay? You should reserve it for yourselves. Never share it with strangers. Now, that's not a loophole to have sex with someone you know really well. Never share it with strangers. It's talking about the whole context of that passage is saying sex is meant for you and your wife. It's written to young boys, that part, because it starts with my son. Versus wait until you're sure and use a condom. Okay, so there's kind of a different game going on here. It's the same game, actually. It's just different rules. Different rules in the dating game. Okay? So when I was growing up, I had friends who had girlfriends and they were sleeping together. That was normal to them. And in fact, when I was in Liverpool working, there was a young man in our church who he was kind of straddling both worlds because he was very much a part of our church, but he was very much a part of his own friendship groups outside of church, which is a good thing. And at one point in a social setting, and I can't remember what the trigger comment was, he blurted out, I'm not a virgin! And then he realized where he was. He thought, oh no, I was using this language from here, in this place here. Because here we celebrate virginity. We think it's a good thing if you're not married. That's how it worked. And he kind of blushed and someone else changed the subject. And I don't even know if he was or wasn't a virgin. He just felt it was wrong to admit because it's kind of a shame in the rules of this game of the world. It's kind of a shamefulness. I mean, we've got a film called The 40-Year-Old Virgin and it's just taken to mean that, well, that's odd. That's something wrong with that guy. Well, it's not quite how the Bible sees things. And I'm going to actually look at that word virgin in a little while. And I've nearly finished and you can start breathing again. And next week we'll talk about marriage and it'll be a lot safer. I'll not mention sex once, maybe once. Okay. So this tension between the two worlds that I live in and still live in today, the church world and the non-church world, I feel is boiled down to this one difference of, and it's not for everybody this, but for a lot of people in the world just see sex as a physical act. And I think the media treats it as a physical act. You look at some pop music, you look at movies, you look at certain sitcoms that you watch that are funny, but then actually, although they're funny, there's stuff going on in those sitcoms that just have an underlying value that's, it's assumed everyone agrees that sex is physical and it's okay, you know, just be safe. And then on the other hand, what I've grown up in church and what I've talked about already, the sex is beautiful, it's more than physical. Now, you might start thinking, well, I don't know if I agree with that. Some of you might think that sex is just physical, biological. It's very easy to think that, especially if you're a scientific person and you know, I'm not going to tell you the biology of it, I'm sure you already know, but there's a biological act that goes on. You could see it as just physical. But without getting too deep, if you've been sexually abused, it will take you a lot longer to get over it than if you've been verbally abused. Now, doesn't that tell you something? If you've been sexually abused, it'll take you a lot longer to get over that than if you've been physically abused. Counselors will tell you that. Nurses will tell you that. Doctors will tell you that. Teachers will tell you that. It takes a lot longer to get over it because there's something deep that goes on inside, more than just the physical. Just a thought. Now, what else would a loving God say to you then? Now, I'm only telling this because I love you, and I want you to have the best life you can possibly have. My goal, my personal goal, and I actually write this down in a journal just about every day because it's a discipline that I found helpful. Even though it's the same words and I could just look back, I actually write down, I exist to bring people closer to God and the abundant life he has for them by enjoying him myself. So I exist to bring people closer to God and the abundant life that he has for them. God's got an abundant life for you. And I'm only telling this because I love you, because I think this is these are the happiest people on earth who live by these rules, these ideas. I'm not forcing you to do anything. But you might also think, well, what's a first century bit of writing, which is what we're going to go into now, what the Apostle Paul wrote, how can that still be relevant in the 21st century? How can something that was written in the first century AD, within 100 years of Jesus' death and birth, how can that be relevant today in the 21st century? Surely everything's changed. Some things have changed. In a place called Corinth, it was worse than it is here today. You can see a map of Corinth. Okay, there it is. Now you can see from its strategic position, Corinth was exceptionally useful in trade because you could get at it from lots of angles. So Corinth was the capital of the region that you can see that it's in there. It was a capital city, but it was renowned in the first century, we're going to look at a book called 1 Corinthians, which is a book that Paul wrote, it was a letter Paul wrote to a church in Corinth in the first century. Corinth was renowned for its sexual activity. So in those days in Corinth, you were either a Christian, and there weren't many of those because it was a new breed of doing things. You might be Jewish, but otherwise you'd be pagan, right? So if you're pagan, that means you worship sort of gods, and with a small g, probably the gods of your ancestors. You might pray to your dead ancestors, but probably not. You probably just pray to gods to try and get things working for you, but there was absolutely no concept that those gods loved you. That was just completely weird. And so there was absolutely no concept that you would love those gods either. So the idea of a loving God was just totally weird in Corinth. There was temple prostitution amongst the pagan gods. So what would happen is, you know, the priest of a pagan temple would act a bit like a pimp. That means you'd pay the priest and then you'd take a girl, and that'll be part of your worship. We don't see that in Brixham. Not that I haven't seen it anyway. I mean, there are people in in Devon and Cornwall who call themselves pagans, and they're into some kind of pagan stuff, but usually that's kind of getting back to nature. And there is some spirituality tied up with that. and some dark stuff tied up with that as well. But this kind of paganism was, a lot of it was all about the sex. So in that context, Paul was concerned for the Corinth church, the Corinthian church, because they were new Christians and they didn't quite know how to behave and they were being influenced by all the stuff around them. Should we eat meat that's been offered to idols, these pagan idols? Are we allowed to eat that? It's been offered to them and then it's gone on the market. Are we allowed to eat that? Is that bad? Is that sinful? And then there were these other guys going around, some Greek thinkers. You know how Greeks are renowned for their wisdom and their philosophy? Well, some Greek philosophers were going around saying, well, actually, sex is sinful, even within marriage. You shouldn't be having sex in marriage. It's unfortunate that you've got to have sex to have children, but apart from that, sex is sinful because it's immoral, you shouldn't be doing it. And the Corinthians are asking all these questions to Paul. They've actually written Paul a letter, you'll know, because he refers to it in a few moments. So Paul's concerned, he's worried that the Corinthian church just needs some correction on some issues. So when we dive into what he writes to them, we get an interesting insight into what Corinth was like, but we need to understand that context, because he says some stuff that might actually seem a bit weird to us. Like he says it's better if you don't get married at all. Well, that's because in that context, at the moment, it's just easier for you new Christians, you baby Christians, just to get strong in Christ and then let him lead you to the right person. Anyway, let's just dive in and have a look. Just before he says, we're going to pick it up in Romans 7. But just before he goes into Romans 7, at the end of Romans 6, he talks about sexual immorality, and he says that sexual sin is in a totally separate category from all other sins, right? It's 1 Corinthians 6, around about 18, I don't know, I haven't written it down, but it's an interesting backdrop to this chapter. All other sins are committed outside of the body, but he who sins sexually sins against himself. All other sins, but he who sins sexually. There's two categories of sin in Paul's mind. All sin plus the second category, which is sexual sin. He sees it as a separate category because it hurts people when you get it wrong. It hurts you and it hurts somebody else, and it might hurt a third party as well. And it can take years to uncover some of that hurt. So in all of that, he comes to what we now call, not Romans, 1 Corinthians 7. And he says, now, for the matters you wrote about, it is good for a man not to have sexual relations with a woman. Okay? Now, the Greek word there for sexual relations is actually touch. So what he's really saying is, if you interpret it literally, is it is good for a man not to touch a woman. Now, that doesn't mean we've got to just be careful and like, that is not a sin, okay? I've just touched a woman's shoulder. Hope you didn't mind being used as an example there. It's the idea of a sexual touch. It is good for a man. Just avoid that. But, verse 2, since sexual immorality is occurring, and I've told you that it was occurring in Corinth, but it was also occurring in the church. Paul has to deal with an issue where there's a young man sleeping with his stepmother. His father's still alive, and they're all living in the same house. So that there is a lot of sexual immorality occurring. And because of that, Paul says in verse 2, each man should have sexual relations with his own wife, and each woman with her own husband. So what I'm learning from this is marriage is the context for sex. Verse 3, the husband should fulfill his marital duty to his wife. What that means, and the wife likewise to her husband, what that means is this is answering the question of, is it sinful for married people to have sex? Because these Greek guys are even teaching that sex is sinful. There was a guy called Origen who wrote a whole load of stuff to the Christian church and was hugely influential and believed the Bible. But one of the things Origen taught was that sex was sinful, and it was a shame that we had, like I said before. And so these are Christian guys even saying that sex was sinful. And Paul is saying, no, don't withhold having sex with your wife, with your husband. That's the place it's meant to take place. So some were teaching against sex. These are God-given desires. They are meant for marriage. And I know what I'm saying is countercultural. That means I know what I'm saying goes against what the dating game, the rules of the game in the world. But it was then as well. So when you say, well, I can't apply the Bible to the modern day, it was just as hard to apply in those days as it is today. And then he goes on to say in verse 7, I wish that all of you were as I am. And what he means by that is single, right? Now, he means that in the context of a very corrupt world. In fact, he means it for two reasons. As I researched it, Paul could see that there was a great persecution coming. And it's actually unfair to get married and have children when you know that you're likely to be, if you're an all-out follower of Christ, you're likely to be dragged away and killed for your faith. And actually, right now, while there's a persecution looming, it's probably best if you just don't get married. Because it's just not fair on the person you're marrying. You're just going to cause them so much trouble and distress. So that's why he's saying, I wish that all of you were as I am. But also, the second reason is because of the Corinthian mess that they found themselves in. So they were meant to be salt and light. They were meant to be a shining light, explaining to the world what Jesus was like. And it's just a whole lot easier to do that right there, right then, in Corinth, if they stayed single. But each of you has your own gift from God. One has this gift, another has that. So that is the gift of being celibate. That means not having a wife. The gift of singleness. As Paul saw, he had a gift of singleness. I wish you were all as I am. Not many people could write that, could they? So he's not criticizing marriage. He's just saying right now, it's easier to be single. Right now in Corinth, it's easier to be single. Verse 8, now to the unmarried and to the widows, I say, it's good for them to stay unmarried, as I do. But if they cannot control themselves, they should marry. Right, okay. So what that means is, if you've got so much lust, right, so much passion sexually, it's better that you marry. So it's taken as read that the only place that you'd have sex was in the context of marriage. Because if you've got so much passion that you need to express, the best thing for you to do is get married. It says in verse 9, I just read that, for the second half of it says, for it is better to marry than to burn with passion. Right, that's fair enough, and he's written to a certain congregation that he knows, and he's probably got someone in his mind that he knows about that we don't know, and so in some cases that might be true. Paul would also say, it's better not to marry, because he said that already, hasn't he? It's better, in fact, if Paul would allow me to add any words, I'd like him to let me to add, it's better to marry the right person than to burn with passion. Because if you marry the wrong person, so not that there's just like one right person, I'm not going to get into all of that. Is there just one person for everybody? How does that work mathematically? I'm not going to get into all that. But it's better to marry someone who's right for you than to burn with passion. Because it's actually better not to marry at all than marry someone who's going to just cause you so much heartache and pain. It's better to deal with your lust problem than to deal with an unhappy marriage. And in fact, I think that's probably easier for God to deal with. Because as soon as you bring someone else in, you're into relationship issues. I'm going to talk a little bit more about that right at the very, very end anyway. And then he goes on to this word, virgins. Now, if I was caught up in prison, right, and some of you probably hope I will be, if I was caught up in prison and I wrote a letter to Brixham Community Church and I wanted to address certain people groups within the church, I can't imagine saying, and now to the virgins. I write to the virgins. You know, it just doesn't sit right in our language. So I went into a Bible dictionary, and I went into something called a lexicon, which is where you look up a word and you see what it means, not just like a dictionary, but how it's used generally in the language of that time. Now, in the Old Testament, the word virgin comes from the same root word as to separate.
So for the Old Testament, the word virgin means someone who has separated themselves. They're waiting. They're separating themselves from sexual activity and they're waiting for their bride or for their groom. In the New Testament, it more specifically means, if it's used in the feminine sense, an unmarried maiden, and the implication, wherever it's used, not just in the Bible, wherever that's used in Greek texts, the implication is always that it's someone who hasn't had sex before. And for a man, it has the connotation of someone who has kept themselves from all uncleanness, and they haven't had sex. So for Paul, when he's writing the Bible, when he uses the word virgin, he just means someone who's not married. For him, it's very easy in his culture, in his context, to use that word to mean someone who is single. Quite interesting. Doesn't fit the rules of the dating game that I see around me. The advice isn't about sex before marriage, if you look at the verse. They haven't even asked, because they know what he thinks already. The advice is whether or not they should get married. And Paul talks about, in verse 26, he says, because of the present crisis, I think that it's good for a man to remain as he is. And that present crisis is this thing I was talking about. There's the Roman persecution coming, and it's probably best, you're going to be in a lot more trouble. If you get married, one of you dies because of the persecution, it's probably easier to stay single. Verse 27, I've nearly finished. Are you pledged to a woman? Are you engaged, in other words? Men, are you engaged? Don't seek to be released, right? So he's trying to say, wherever you are right now, stay as you are and try and serve God in that situation. If you're engaged, stay engaged. Don't listen to these guys who are saying, oh, sex is sin, you shouldn't get married and all that sort of thing. Are you free from such a commitment, or are you not engaged? Don't look for a wife. Just stay where you are and try and be happy. And try and serve the Lord with all of you got, wherever you are. There may be trouble ahead. There's a song in there. Focus on God, not on the wife hunt. Last verse, verse 28. By the way, you'll have noticed I've skipped verses. Those verses are specifically written to married couples, and I'm talking to singles today, talking to marrieds next week. I might dip into some of the verses I've skipped over. Verse 28. But if you do marry, you've not sinned. And if a virgin marries, she's not sinned. So it's using the virgin in the feminine tense there. So it's if it's a female, because it's implied that usually it would be a male who is reading this. But those who marry will face many troubles in this life. There's a lot of knowing nods and grins amongst the marrieds this morning. Now he's talking about the persecution. I don't know why you're nodding and grinning knowingly, because we live in a free society where we're not persecuted, are we? I don't know. Not like they were. And I want to spare you this. Okay, well, it is true. Even if there isn't a persecution, here's a few myths that I've seen going around. If I get married, some of my troubles will disappear. Actually, when you get married, your troubles will probably increase. I mean, it's lovely. It's like living with your best friend, and there's the sex, and there's the companionship, and there's children, if you're blessed with children. But there's also a lot of troubles, because you bring your baggage with you, all your emotional hang-ups that you didn't even know you had, and some of that baggage is time sensitive. It's not even unlocked until you get married. It's true, isn't it? You don't recognize some of that time-sensitive baggage that you're carrying, like things that you think are right, things you think are the right way of doing things, things that you think just are important, that probably aren't, but they feel so important to you. They're sort of deep underneath the surface. Some of them don't even get unlocked until you get married. So marriage won't sort out all your problems. Marriage will cure me of loneliness. Actually, doesn't always do that. He goes out to work and you end up lonely. You're just as lonely as you were before. You come home and you get an argument, and the sex that you got married for doesn't even happen for a while, and I'm still lonely. Marriage won't cure you of loneliness necessarily. Might do, might not. Can't guarantee it. There's always trouble when you get married. Marriage will cure me of my sexual temptation. Not true. Men, you'll still notice other women. Just like when, and this isn't meant to be like a dodgy metaphor, but when you've climbed a mountain that's beautiful, doesn't mean you won't notice other mountains. They're still beautiful. It's just you're not allowed to climb those ones. Okay. I've probably said enough. I've tried... Marriage won't cure you of deep emotional needs or general difficulties. Sorry. All right. So here's a few game-changing thoughts when we're thinking about the dating game. A few game-changing thoughts. I put my notes down. I forgot what I was going to say next. I'm still distracted thinking about mountains. How lovely on the mountains are the feet of him who bring good news. Right, I've sanctified my mind now. What was I going to say? Game-changing thought. This is like the climax of the sermon. I can't force you to take any course of action. I can't force you to believe one thing or another. I can't force you to do anything. I can bring you what I believe the scripture's teaching, and then you can go and do whatever you like. And honestly, I won't judge you. I'll just tell you what I think the Bible teaches. I might be a bit sad, but I won't judge you, because that's one of our values. We're high on acceptance, low on judgment. But I might have kind of a judgment of your actions in my heart that actually what you're doing might not be right, as far as I understand the scripture. And I'm only telling you this because I love you. But just think about this game-changing thought, and I did have two thoughts. The first one is something I said in January when we were talking about decision-making. What you do will become a permanent part of your story. Whatever you do will become a permanent part of your story. And the question I asked in January, when the youth were out but the adults were in, was, what story do I want to tell? Because one day, you will sit with someone who you think, this is the one, this is it. And if you want to be entirely transparent with that person, you want to know their story. You want to know all their sexual past. You'll want to. You will. Don't tell me you won't, because you will. And they'll want to know your story. Spare yourself the agony, because you've got two choices then. You can either gloss over stuff and still have that slight difference between you, because there's a lack of intimacy when you withhold information from your wife or husband. There's a gap there, because you know something they don't know, and really you feel like you should have told them. So you've got the option of not telling them everything, or you've just got the agony of saying, well, this is what I did. So do what you like, because you've got free will and I can't force you to do anything. But please bear in mind, whatever you do is a permanent part of your story. Now, I know God forgives. And if anyone is feeling condemned this morning, that certainly is not my intention. And God is a forgiving, loving God. And he can wipe the past clean. And as far as God's concerned, you never did that thing. Isn't that wonderful? I'm going to say that again. As far as God's concerned, you never did that thing. If you've asked God for forgiveness, it's done. As far as the east is from the west, that's how far he's removed your sins from you. Like Paul said earlier, he doesn't just wipe the slate clean, he throws the slate away. That's between you and God. But your partner might not be the same. Your story is still there. In fact, you still did the thing, and his forgiveness is part of your story, but it's still part of your story. The second game-changing thought I felt was important to share with you. I've forgotten that one as well. Yeah, well, it was this idea that I used to get a lot in RE lessons, that, to put it crudely, try before you buy. The idea that if we live together first, we'll find out if we're sexually compatible, and we'll just have like a trial mock-up marriage situation, and then if it works, we'll get married. Okay, well, you're not a statistic, but statistically, your marriage won't work, is less likely to work. Statistically, I think you're 5 times more likely to end up in divorce if you've lived together before you get married. I don't know why, I'm just telling you the stats, okay? But you're not a statistic, you're a human being, and you know, that's fair enough. But I just thought it was important to think about that. It's also thought, while we're thinking about statistics, I reckon you're probably sexually compatible with about 1 billion other people. I mean, how many billion people are there on the planet? Let's say 7. Okay, so let's knock out half of them because they're the wrong gender. So that's 3.5 billion other people. Let's knock out another half of them because they're probably underage. I'm just guessing. Okay, so maybe there's about 1 billion other people that biologically you could, you know, be sexually compatible with and probably enjoy it, both of you. It's quite possible. All right, 500 million then. All right, 1,000. What if there's 1,000 people that you're sexually compatible with? The chances are, it's not that hard. Even high school kids do it. It's not hard to have sex. It's not difficult. You don't have to find out if you're sexually compatible. And even if you have problems in that area, they can be dealt with. I tell you what's really hard to deal with, that's relationship incompatibility. That's what you want to find out, and you don't have to live together to find that out. See, although I might be sexually compatible with lots of women, I'm only relationally compatible with Andrea because only she'll put up with me. But we didn't have to sleep together to find that out. Yeah, we had a long courtship, longer than she wanted. We knew each other for 4 years before I proposed. And I was probably too slow, but hey, you know. Better that way around. But we didn't sleep together. Because the harder thing to get right is the relationship than the sexual compatibility. So this try before you buy idea doesn't work for me. It didn't work for me. I didn't even try it, but you get the idea. It wasn't an issue in that respect. So I'd like you to close your eyes. I just want you to picture yourself. Picture yourself as feeling totally secure. You don't have any insecurities. You don't feel lonely, but you do feel surrounded by love. Picture yourself. What do you look like? Happy and fulfilled. Picture yourself with a sense of purpose. So imagine all those things about you. What are you doing? You're not insecure. You feel total security. You're not lonely, but you're surrounded by love. You're happy and fulfilled, and you've got a sense of purpose. And I want you to imagine you're single. It is possible. In fact, that would make you the most attractive person to the opposite sex. So if you are single, why not concentrate on becoming the person that you're looking for is looking for? Why not concentrate on becoming that whole person without needing a partner to prop you up, without needing another half to make you feel whole, to find your completeness in Christ and your security in Him?